listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that gives you access to women who are contributing, inspiring, trailblazing, and disrupting the business of technology. We believe that when women inspire other women, amazing things happen. I'm your host, Allison Wade.
And I am your host, Jessie Sterenshoes, and we are connecting women around the world to share ideas that help us thrive and advance in our personal lives and in our careers.
Be sure to share this podcast with your friends, rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and help us bring Women Who Change Tech into the lives of more professionals.
Hold on to your seats as we give you a dose of inspiration from some of the most talented and creative women who are shifting the face of technology.
Hi, Jessie. How are you today?
I am doing fantastic. How are you, Allison?
I'm good.
Yeah. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm another year older. Can't believe it.
You are, and you're going in reverse, which is just insane.
Why, thank you, Jessie.
It's ridiculous, actually. Give me whatever you're having, please.
It's my calm lifestyle. That's what it is.
Yeah, totally. You're the calmest of calm.
That's right. Yeah, Jessie and I have actually been having a great time. Like we said, we're often far apart in other parts of the world, but this last weekend, we were together a lot. We went to a fabulous day at a farm called Congre Pen, which is in our neighborhood in Jacksonville, where they grow cool foods and they have cute animals and they have these amazing functions and they make all of their own rice and preserves and the food was fabulous. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was beautiful. They had these fields of clover and beautiful fuchsia poppies. It was gorgeous. We even got to pet goats. It was crazy in the best way possible.
Yeah, it was a really nice weekend.
It was.
And then we got to celebrate my birthday.
We did. And we put our faces in big jelly donuts. It was delicious.
Those were the best donuts. I swear, we have a local place near us called Sweet Theory, and the donuts are vegan. And the listeners are going, yuck, a vegan donut. No. Yum, yum, yum. These are the best donuts on the planet. And these ones happen to be filled with jelly. My husband got them for us and we chowed down.
Yeah, we had like powdered sugar all over our faces. It was quite the scene, but it was worth every second of it. It was delicious.
And I'm really excited today because we're going to be talking to Melissa Benoit. Melissa is an incredible woman. She has been speaking at Women Who Test and also at our mobile conferences, our other testing conferences. She's a very technical tester. She's had a lot of really great experience working for companies like Boeing and Microsoft and PlayFab, a gaming company. And she's just got a lot of knowledge. So I can't wait to introduce you to Melissa today. I want to introduce everyone today to Melissa Benoit. Melissa is a woman who is a problem solver. I first met Melissa through our mutual friend, James Whitaker, when I was looking for more women in tech to come and speak. And James recommended Melissa to me, and we haven't looked back ever since. She spoke in 2015 at our Star West conference, later at our Mobile Dev and Test conference, and she has been contributing a lot of valuable content ever since then, not only to the conferences, but to the industry. And she's spoken on topics like, can your mobile infrastructure survive 1 million concurrent users? Test design for fully automated build architectures, elegant dev and test processes for a more civilized age, engineering for compatibility. She's also been a speaker at the Women Who Test Day, and she spoke on such topics as the lone female voice of reason, and she's going to be giving a talk this May on imposter syndrome and the art of being wrong. Melissa has a degree in computer science, and she's worked at Boeing, Microsoft, PlayFab, a gaming company, and is currently senior engineering manager at mParticle. She has two of the most adorable kids who are frequent conference attendees, and I love getting to see them along with Melissa. Everybody, welcome Melissa. Hey, Melissa.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. We're so glad you're with us today.
So glad we could make it.
Awesome. So tell our listeners a little bit about you and your background, so and then we can start getting into some other content and talking about the work that you do and have done in testing, and also some of the other work that you're doing in other parts of your life.
Yeah, of course. So I've had pretty much every software dev role that there is. I've been a developer in test. I've been a straight developer. I've done some DevOps work. I've done some program management. Now I've lately been doing a lot of tech lead and now team management. So I've done a little bit of everything.
And tell us about some of the companies that you've worked at, because you've had quite a auspicious career, you know, with companies like Boeing and Microsoft, and then you worked at some startups.
Yeah, I spent a good about 9 years at the big companies. Most recently, I was at Microsoft. I worked on Bing and on Cortana. And so after a good 9 years, I decided I was ready for something a little bit smaller. So I've been at startups ever since. And by startups, I mean my first startup, I was employee number 10, I believe.
Nice.
And at my second company, where I'm at currently at mParticle, I think I was employee number 50 and engineer number 18. So pretty early still.
Yeah.
What was it like going from being at like a really large enterprise company to such a small company? What was that transition like?
I mean, there's definitely some culture shock. There's things you don't do when you're at a company like Microsoft. You know, you don't worry about where does my laptop come from and does it have an operating system on it? You don't worry about what version of Visual Studio do I have? You don't worry about whole slew of things that when you are at a very small company that doesn't maybe have an IT department or corporate policies that you sort of have to do or invent yourself. Mm-hmm. Sort of the power of being used to relying on somebody else or a whole team of somebody else to do a function and then realizing there is nobody else. It's just you. Regardless of what that function is, sometimes it's just you and you may have to do it.
Yeah. Was that refreshing? Was it hard? What did you think?
It was hard at first. It definitely took me a couple of months to sort of get out of the idea that somebody else was going to do X for me. Mm-hmm. The most recent example. So my team has been hiring. I've been hiring pretty extensively for my team here at mParticle, and we had outgrown our office space. And we were on the wait list for a bigger space and a wait list and a wait list and a wait list. And it was going to the point where I couldn't hire anymore. So I, on my own, went out with a realtor, found the new space, talked to my manager, said, this is the space we want. We're going to have this space. And he said, okay, that's in budget. We signed the lease and we moved.
You didn't mention you were also a realtor.
Apparently I'm a realtor and a space designer.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
But, you know, having the power to make those choices, to see that there's a problem and then be empowered to go and fix it, regardless of in what domain that problem is sort of the thing I love the most about startups and small companies.
Mm-hmm. Nice. How is it being there to watch the company grow right now? What's that like?
Oh my God, it's so cool. We're on pace to double this year. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it's incredible. There's a lot of really interesting challenges in doubling a team, you know, doubling a company.
Yeah.
Scaling. I spent most of my life scaling backend services, scaling web services. And so now scaling a company in the same way is interesting to apply those concepts.
Yeah, that is actually really interesting because I know you did a lot of that. I know at like PlayFab, you had to do a lot of scaling for like millions and millions of users, right?
Yes. One of our big things was PlayFab was when your game launched on launch day, you never know if you're going to get one user or 10 users or a million users. And so our big value prop was we'll handle the scaling for you since, you know, many small game companies don't know what to do with a million concurrent users. And so that with that being our value prop, we had to make really sure that that was actually the case. We weren't all words about it.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
A lot of testing. Yeah. So that was where we sort of the first time I was sort of led to transform from more traditional dev practices into continuous delivery. Mm-hmm. and moving over to continuous delivery sort of freed up our very limited engineering resources to be able to test better, to put more investment into working with our infrastructure to make sure it was going to scale. Mm-hmm. It sort of just freed up a lot of bandwidth that used to be spent worrying how in the world are we going to get this code change into production? Mm-hmm. And into how in the world are we going to make sure this code change in production is going to scale to a million plus users concurrently?
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so how does that translate over to doubling in size with the company? So going from something technical and testing to what you're doing now? Because you said they kind of compare in some ways.
They do. And the big one is really highlighting the value of process, of documentation, and of automation where automation is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having a clean process such that when you bring a new person on, it's not a mountain of work and you're inventing whole new things, they can just follow the existing process and they onboard in the right way without having to be, you know, extensively handheld. Having automation, you know, to create accounts automatically.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about automation and manual testing. I think you are fairly strong in both of those areas, wouldn't you say, that you've done a lot of work in both of those areas, and how you think that plays today in most companies where testers are working on and what they're doing?
Yeah, I have definitely done both. When I was in Estet, we did, you know, we wrote a lot of automation, but we also had bug bashes all the time. For a while, I was the manual security tester finding cross-site scripting exploits and that sort of thing when I was on Bing. And so nowadays, the way I see it most often is, at my company, for example, we don't actually have a QA org, but that doesn't mean we're not doing those QA functions. Mm-hmm. And so the traditional QA org functionalities have sort of split into two, maybe three divisions. Automation testing in itself has rolled into the dev org. Automation framework maintenance has rolled into a dev org, but it's a team very focused on automation maintenance because that's sort of a separate skill set. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the manual testing, right? Finding what we would call the bugs of intention as opposed to the bugs of implementation. Right. So finding those manual testing bugs of intention sort of thing has rolled up into some of our product org and our project management, where they go through and do the manual testing, manual validation after a feature has been delivered. And since they're, you know, the product owners, it's sort of a natural fit.
Right. So you definitely still see value in the world of manual testing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's things that regression testing will never cover. Right. There's things that automation will miss.
Right. Yeah, I was just recently talking with Chris Loader about a talk he's going to do on automation, and he was saying how really being a lazy person made him a really good automator, because there was those things that he just refused to do on a daily basis that he's like, I'm going to automate the heck out of this so I don't have to do it. And I think that's a great perspective for a tester to have.
That is a great perspective. And for any tester, developer, engineer, I'd like to believe that the best engineers are all fundamentally lazy.
That's awesome. I'm going to share that with Chris. He's going to love it.
I feel like that's something Bill Gates might have said, is that he's fundamentally lazy. I don't know if that's true, but I feel like I remember reading that somewhere.
Dang, he doesn't look fundamentally lazy. He looks like he's doing a million things, but
just in the need to automate things, right? To free up your time, mm-hmm. not have to do repetitive, boring tasks over and over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. So you talked a little bit about continuous delivery and how much you're talking at the conferences a lot about that, like transitioning old code bases into continuous models. And, you know, that is definitely what's going on in companies with DevOps and this constant continuous delivery. And it's now sort of like the new norm, I think. And talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So it comes out of my experience doing it. We've done it functionally three times now. We did it at Bing, where we went from this wacky 3-month-long delivery process, and it was not an easy rollout. And we did it again at PlayFab, which I talk about in one of my talks, and we're doing it again at mParticle. We're pretty close now. You know, just taking that code base that may ship on some medium to long schedule, you know, maybe the tests run, maybe they don't, but it's not, you know, it's not slick and it's not easy. Just transforming that into something that you don't have to think about, that just works, that you can just rely upon. Talking about setting up automation tests so that devs can run them routinely and have value in them. Mm-hmm. Setting up your deployment so that you don't have to have 5 or 6 engineers dedicated between DevOps and engineering watching the code go. But then the part that people often don't think about is the observability, is setting up your monitoring after the fact. Mm-hmm. Because part of I like to call it the backstop of your continuous delivery and of your testing strategy is going to be metrics, monitors, and counters in particular to tell you when something has gone wrong.
Yeah.
Sort of when I give these talks to testers and I say, we're not going to test everything, you're going to miss something.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I hear that a lot, that monitoring is sort of a forgotten aspect of the continuous delivery cycle.
Yes. It's definitely the forgotten aspect. It's probably the most important. That's how you're going to find issues, at least as your customers are finding them. Mm-hmm. Your customers may not tell you that something's broken. They may just go away. So if you don't know that something's gone wrong, you may not find out until your revenue drops next quarter.
Right. Exactly. Very interesting. So from this greatly technical background, you said you're transitioning more into management. So tell us a little bit about your current role. I know you said you're out shopping for real estate and doing all those sorts of things, but I feel like you're doing a lot more in terms of managing the org, building the org. Tell us how your role has changed, what you're still doing from the things that you've done in the past and what you're doing now in terms of sort of moving into more of a management role and what you like about that.
Yeah. So I have more or less three teams underneath me. So I'm basically doing three roles. I'm functioning as the tech lead for those teams. I'm also the manager for those three teams. And I also own a lot of quality processes, continuous delivery from the engineering point of view, not necessarily from the DevOps point of view, and sort of how we handle some of our internal hiring processes. So there's three different jobs that I'm doing right now, but I really enjoy them. I mean, it's the sort of thing that I like applying the principles that I've learned from engineering and the principles that I've gained over the last 15 years about, you know, what is a healthy team? What is a healthy org? And how does the intermixing of technology and process and, you know, human soft skills, how does that all come to play together to build a really healthy group that can churn out really good code?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's something you're naturally very good at. I remember back, I think it was like probably 2015 when you first gave that talk about, you know, when you're the lone voice of reason in a group. So maybe you're one tester in a bunch of developers and you're having to tell them that their code is ugly. But then what about when you're not only are you the lone tester, but maybe you're the lone female in this group of guys and you're having to give them sort of negative feedback. And you gave a talk about lots of really practical ways to deal with that and not to derail yourself. And that's often something that you can get sort of emotionally derailed on, but you gave like a lot of good, strong advice about that.
Yeah. It's still true in my day-to-day life now. I'm continued to be the only female engineer in my team, despite an incredible effort that I've made in hiring otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it's still true, right? So I have three key areas that I try to do. One of which is always having data and always being able to speak to your data. Mm-hmm. You know, always backing up your opinion on data, especially when you're coming in with a disagreement or a potential issue, to try to avoid getting into emotional he said, she said, you know, my opinion is this, my opinion is that. And then one of the other principles is not being afraid to be wrong on the way to being right. Oh, being comfortable making mistakes.
Yeah. That's a hard one for a lot of people to learn in general, right?
It's really hard. Right? Nobody likes to think of themselves as somebody who's wrong, right? We don't want to adapt that as part of our personality. But on the other hand, if you're never wrong, you're never learning.
Right. Absolutely.
That's so true. So what are you doing in order to try to grow a more diverse team? Have you figured out a way to not be the lone woman? It sounds like it's still a struggle.
It's still a struggle. So I'm able to hire diversity in men pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
You pick a diversity metric in men, and I've hired it.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple women come through. I've had a couple offers out. Just for one reason or the other, hasn't worked out.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've noticed is it's very hard to hire your first female engineer. Very hard. It's almost equally as hard to hire your second female engineer. But once you have two, it seems to be that you can hire as many as you like beyond that point.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm not sure if there's something reassuring about seeing more than, I mean, for myself personally, I would think there's something reassuring about seeing more than two women in a team when you're evaluating choices.
Mm-hmm.
I know that our market in Seattle is quite hot right now for hiring engineers. And so I know several big companies in the area as well also have very large incentives to hire female engineers. And so I know what we're competing against from that point of view as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know that there have been very targeted incentives. And I know for me personally, I don't feel comfortable joining a team unless I can see at least one other technical woman there.
Mm-hmm.
Two is better, but hasn't happened for me in a long time.
Have you both seen that new short film? I think it's Pixar put it out recently. And it's like, it's a ball of yarn.
Oh, Pearl.
Yes, Pearl. Yeah. And it's like about hiring and she's the only female.
Oh, wow. I have not seen it. That's,
It's so good, but it was making me think about what you're saying, Melissa.
Yeah, it was exactly.
coming into that environment and how hard it is to be the first one. And then it's kind of like follow the follower, right? It's the second follower. But then once there's three or four, then it becomes easier and easier. And it's the same thing about like kind of those outliers. But then once you see more of yourself, then the easier it becomes. But those first few are always the hardest.
Yeah, I actually found it. So there's a part of Pearl, not to give too many spoilers, mm-hmm. but where she sees herself that the only way for her to move forward is to be like one of the guys.
Yeah.
So she transforms herself into yeah. one of the guys. And I definitely have experienced that in my career. There was a time where I was just going to be one of the guys and I was going to poo-poo on all things female because I was just one of the guys and I was going to hang out and I could be, you know, just as good a guy as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And that got me pretty far for a while. Mm-hmm. That sort of fell apart as soon as I started experiencing female specific issues, mm-hmm. especially when I was pregnant with my daughter.
Yeah.
A lot of the culture and the persona that I had built up sort of fell apart. And at the time, before this all happened, I had this view of, oh, it's not that hard to be a woman in engineering. Look, I'm just one of the guys too, and nobody ever treats me so badly or so strangely. Mm-hmm. But yet, as soon as I started experiencing problems that men didn't have a scope for it, I had hyperemesis with both of my pregnancies, for example. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, a lot of that, oh, I'm just one of you, I can do whatever I need, do whatever I need to do that a man can do, sort of fell apart. Mm-hmm. When I started experiencing more of that bias that can happen sometimes when you're a woman and there's nobody else around you that shares your experience.
Exactly.
And that's interesting. I actually see that bias from other young women sometimes too, who, like you said, they have that mindset that you have like, oh, I'm no different. Because they don't want to be different, truthfully. So they're
exactly.
kind of almost convincing themselves that there is no difference between them and the other guys in the industry. They're just one of the guys. And I don't see any of that. I don't need any of this feminism. I don't need any of this female stuff. And then later on, they're like, oh my gosh, I was so naive. Like,
Exactly. I look back at myself and I'm like, oh gosh, that was so sweet and innocent to believe that.
Right.
They don't know better. They haven't had the experiences yet.
Yeah. And well, I've had some managers in the past that profess that they love having female employees and they love to hire more women and blah, blah, blah. When what they're really saying underneath is they would love to hire more women as long as the women behave exactly like men.
Right.
It's interesting. And I think it's compounded too with like what you said, like when you mix in the environment where it's highly competitive, you live in a place where everybody's competing for talent and there's already less talent that's diverse, unfortunately, you know, so that makes it even harder. So dealing yep. with all that just makes the situation, I would imagine, much more difficult.
So you said that before when you were kind of had a persona that you were kind of pushing and that now you're obviously the much more authentic Melissa. How did you get to that point and what are the benefits from being authentic Melissa?
I was sort of forced to the point, both when I was pregnant and as I said, I was so sick. And then when I had my daughter and it was just, I couldn't do it anymore. I needed, for the first few months, I just didn't have the bandwidth to pretend. And then as time progressed, I found that I just wanted to be more myself. I needed certain things. I needed a certain balance in my life that I hadn't had before. And I just wanted to be who I was so that my daughter could feel comfortable being, you know, eventually being who she is.
So true.
I love all these deep sighs we're having when we talk about this. The deep sighs of recognition, right?
Yeah, it was definitely a sea change for me when yeah. I had my daughter. You know, and again, when I had my son, it sort of crystallized that who I'm willing to be and who I'm not. Mm-hmm. And one of my goals actually with moving into management is to make it okay to be more feminine or to be a parent, you know, because men have that too, right? Men want to be parents. They want to be involved in family life just as much as women do.
Yes.
There's just not a lot of role modeling of that. So one of the things I wanted to do and why I bring my children to the conferences and so on is I want to role model mm-hmm. what it could be.
Yeah.
I mean, it hasn't always been easy for me and sometimes it's backfired on me, but I feel passionately that we, as a society and as a culture, especially in engineering, need to be okay with the fact that people have lives and families and children.
Yes. Yes. I think there's a few women over the years that have implemented that really well. I know you know Elizabeth Hendrickson, right? Elizabeth is a remarkable a person who's contributed so much to testing and is very well known. And she was probably one of the early first women to do that. Her children are grown now. I think they've even graduated from college. So I'm going to really date myself now. But I remember her bringing her firstborn to the conference in like a little baby Bjorn, because that was the only baby carrier out there on the market at the time. And
right.
we made her daughter a name badge. And over the years, I haven't seen many women who really go there. I think they think they have to keep their kids away and keep whatever. But I love that you bring your two adorable children to the conference. They're so wonderful to see them and see them see you doing business and being a mom. And your husband is a great caretaker for your kids. And he's always there supporting you. And it's great to see.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do it without him, certainly. We have, over the years, have developed a very good partnership where sometimes, you know, sometimes he leans into his career and I step back. But the inverse is also true, right? Sometimes I lean into my career and he steps back. Mm-hmm. And having that balance and being able to sort of strike it, depending on how the current moment demands, has been, I mean, there's no way I could do what I do without him and without that balance.
Yeah, that's tough too. That's definitely a key piece, is to have that support system, like figuring out what your support system and who you have around you to make it work.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I know one thing you were saying is when you're looking for people on your team, you were talking about having particular soft skills. What are those type of skills that you're looking for in people?
Yeah. So the one thing I especially don't want is, I don't want a rock star developer. I don't want a lone wolf developer. I want people who are well-rounded humans who can take criticism in a PR, you know, in a pull request, and not take it personally, mm-hmm. who can have a technical discussion and a technical disagreement without taking it personally or without getting heated about it, and who are pleasant, reasonable people who are investing in team as much as they're investing in themselves, and who aren't likely to throw their team under the bus for their own personal gain.
Mm.
One of our core values is supporting each other. I'd much rather they spend time supporting each other and, you know, getting work done as a whole than getting their own work done to the detriment of everybody else.
How do you screen for that? How do you find out, you know, get to that sort of bottom line to get people to be exposed enough to figure that out? Because everybody puts on a good face in an interview and says, oh yeah, you know, I'm a team player. How do you kind of get to the bottom of that?
So one of the things we do, we get it in a couple different ways, but one of the things we do is I have candidates take sort of a long form programming challenge, where I basically leave them alone in a room for 2 hours with an ID and say, go for it, go to town. And they work on the coding challenge. And then after the 2 hours are up, we do a peer review. You know, we go through, we look at their code, we talk about what they did, what they didn't. I have them describe their approach, and then we talk about alternative approaches, talk about the challenges with their solution, talk about problems. And I find that I get a pretty good feel for who they are during this mini PR review.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they defensive about their code? This is probably mm-hmm. the most stressful situation they're going to be in. So do they, you know, what's their default? Do they default to defensive? Are they interested to learn? Are they, you know, I can see very clearly what their attitude is when they're under stress.
That's awesome.
Yeah, at this point, my sensor for people who are not team players has become pretty well calibrated.
Your BS sensor is really good.
Yeah, we call it something else internally.
Something that you can't say on the air.
Something that I will not say on the air.
We understand.
Tell us later.
That's right. Tell us later. That's awesome. Yeah, that's really good. It is the, do you feel like the culture of the dev rock star and lone wolf is starting to die off now that engineering is being so broadly used and there's so many people in the field? Do you feel like that sort of persona that ruled the dev world forever is starting to die down?
I hope so. I certainly still see it. I think it depends industry to industry. Mm-hmm. I know that I've spoken to a lot of candidates in fintech, in financial tech, and they seem to have it a lot more than maybe somebody in HR software.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it quite a lot in games still. So I think it very depends industry to industry where it's got a strong foothold.
Yeah, gaming is one of the industries that I know that came up. There were some attendees from gaming companies at some of the Women Who Test days, and I know that's something that is dealt with a lot in the gaming industry, is a lot of misogyny and a lot of just heroism in terms of gaming, which kind of fits with the whole game model when you think about it.
It does.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I know a lot of, you know, when I was in the industry, and I know there were many people, supervisors, managers, whatever in the industry, who had this view of, if you're not here for 70 hours, if I don't see you at your desk, you must not be working. I know I definitely had to explain to people, we were at GDC one year, and that was the year of the infamous Microsoft party with the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having to explain to some male people in the industry why that was bad.
Right.
And then they had the baffled question, well, would it have been better if there were men on stage with the women, you know, scantily clad men? And I said, well, actually, yes, it would have been. And then they mm-hmm. continued to be baffled and said to me, but nobody wants to see that. It was just so emblematic of their inability to look outside of themselves.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So beautiful. What do you think? Should we play a game?
Yeah. Before we do that, I just want to ask Melissa one more question. And that is about the new talk that you're doing at Women Who Test about imposter syndrome. And tell us just a little tidbit about that talk. It's coming up in May at Star East, and you know what you're going to be talking about. And you're actually talking with a colleague of yours that you used to work with who is at Microsoft. Is that correct?
Yes. It's actually funnier than that. She was my husband's boss.
Oh, wow.
And she and I bonded over working in groups where there were like, lots of men.
Yeah, he really annoys the heck out of me when he does that too, right?
Yeah, a little bit. So she and I bonded over this. She's no longer his boss. She's, you know, since moved to a different group. But as, you know, she and I have talked over time, we realized we have a lot of the same experiences in regards to imposter syndrome, in regards to being afraid to speak up, being afraid to be wrong, and sometimes being punished for speaking up and being punished for being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of the same experiences and also a lot of the same sort of takeaways and growth over time. And we really wanted to sort of expand that to the generation of women coming after us or coming behind us, you know, the tech generation coming up. She had seen, and I had seen the same thing, where she would be in these, you know, huge meetings, department-wide Microsoft meetings, which is 1,000-something people. When you have the chance to ask, say, the VP of your division questions, you know, there's always a Q&A session afterwards, that a whole bunch of men would spring into the line. And despite the fact that there were maybe 20% women in the room, not one woman would jump in line for the microphone to ask questions of the VP. And then afterwards, he would go through and shake hands. Not one woman jumped up to go and shake his hand. And she said mm-hmm. afterwards that she grabbed a few of them and said, why didn't you ask questions? It's a really good opportunity for visibility. And they said, oh, well, I was afraid that my question would be dumb, or I was afraid that it would be beneath him and I didn't want to bother him. And a few women had that same perspective. And yet when she asked them their questions, she said those questions were more insightful and useful than any question that had been actually asked to the VP.
Right.
And would have been a fantastic visibility moment.
So I know they're going to do a little workshopping, right? And do mm-hmm. a little bit of role playing and do some stuff like that to help instill some of these ideas and skills.
Yep. We're hoping, you know, we want women to start getting comfortable talking about it. It's one thing for us to tell them, but I want them to have some practices that they can just work on in their spare time or with, you know, with other groups of women to really sort of get comfortable speaking up when you might be wrong or you might not. But just be more comfortable taking the chance and experiencing risk in a maybe unsafe way. And to know, most importantly, when it's likely to be safe risk and when it's not.
I like that. Safe risk versus unsafe risk. That's good.
Right. Asking a question of a VP in a big meeting, right? That's the safest risk there is. Because if it's a dumb question, he will never remember you.
Right.
But if it's a smart question, he will.
That's so funny that you put it that way, because most people would think of that as high risk. But when you think about it in that term, it's actually low risk, right?
I definitely asked Steve Ballmer in a meeting, in one of those meetings, I said, why are we changing the name of Windows Phone again? It was when Windows Phone had like 4 different names at that point. He didn't remember me and he answered the question. You mm-hmm. know, 5 minutes later, he didn't know who my face was, but right. it was a low risk thing for me to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though I asked it of Steve Ballmer, who doesn't know, maybe some people think of that as pretty high risk. He was my super boss at that point.
Right, right. He was your super boss. Yeah. Well, Jess, what game do you want to play?
So,
I just wanted to finish. I can't wait, Melissa, to hear the talk. I'm really excited about it. Thank you for agreeing to speak. I'm really excited to meet your co-speaker and can't wait for it.
So, yeah, me too. It's going to be fun.
Yes. So, Jess, what you got for us?
Well, I was thinking we could play a game that's called And to Make Matters Worse.
Ooh.
Sounds like my kind of game.
Slash, we could call it Unsafe Risk.
That's right. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So, how you play is each person adds one particular building block to make the scenario worse and worse by yes-anding the person before them. So we're collaborating on creating just a unsafe, riskier, and riskier scenario.
We're creating the story from hell here?
Yeah, basically, for a made-up person.
Okay.
So one person will start, they just say like one sentence, and then the next person adds the next little piece of information, and it just sort of spirals out of control. And so it would be yes, and this happened. Yes, and to make matters worse, this happened. And to make matters worse, this happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
So everything after the first person is and to make matters worse. Okay.
Okay. Got it.
Do you want me to start just to kick it off?
Sure. Yes, please.
Okay. And then Allison, do you want to go second? And then Melissa, you want to go third? And we'll go in a circle?
Perfect.
Okay. So when Sally woke up in the morning, it was 2 hours later than she had intended.
And then she picked up her smartphone and all of the websites she was responsible for were down.
And then she realized she was still drunk.
Matters worse. She thought she was next to her partner, but she was next to her beer bottle.
And to make matters worse, she realized that she was next to her beer bottle on a beach in the middle of an island.
Correct.
And it was winter.
To make matters worse, he looked out to the water and saw her coat floating away.
Oh, gosh. I don't know where to go with this. And to make matters worse, someone was playing Neil Diamond in the background.
And to make matters worse, her phone was only at 5%.
And to make matters worse, a squirrel came up and took the phone and ran off in its mouth.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. I'd never been stumped before. I'm actually stumped. And to make matters worse, it started pouring with rain and sleet and hail.
Of course it did.
And to make matters worse, there were no more coconut palm trees.
And to make matters worse, it was high tide.
And to make matters worse, the island was shrinking. And there was a volcano in the middle. So the only place she had to go was towards the volcano.
And to make matters worse, the volcano was smoking.
And not a reefer.
And to make matters worse, the volcano erupted. The end.
Holy, what a bad day in hell.
Poor Sally.
Poor Sally. God, that was hilarious.
Oh, I can't breathe. So, that's a great exercise if you're wanting to see if people can collaborate with other people when you're
yes.
You want I think I think you should play that during your new hiring practice. You should say, okay, we're going to play and to make matters worse and just see how bad they can make it.
Yeah. What is their definition of bad exactly?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Were they stuck on a volcano island with no jacket, with no cell phone service, with
they're still drunk
and still drunk with their bottle next to them? Oh my God, that was the bomb, Melissa. When you said that, I thought I was going to die.
The first part may or may not have been culled from real life.
Okay.
Well, our websites are down and
our websites are down and I have like a ridiculous hangover. Oh my God, that's hilarious. I'm still drunk. That's funny.
Good times.
Excellent. Well, we kind of already talked about what's next for Melissa, and we have this little spot where we like to talk about things that are coming up for you. So we've talked about a lot of us, but is there anything else you want to let everybody know about what you're doing?
I'm going to be at a bunch of conferences this year. So I'm going to be at Grace Hopper Seattle starting in March. Very excited for that. I'm going to be at Star East. I'm going to be at Better Agile DevOps in June. And a bunch of other stuff. So I'm pretty excited about that. Also, if there happen to be any engineers, especially female engineers in the Seattle area or who want to live in the Seattle area, I'm hiring constantly and all the time for engineers of all level, as long as they are friendly and collaborative and want to work on some pretty cool stuff at a pretty cool scale.
And could figure out how to fix their websites from an island in the winter, what with a volcano. While being drunk. Small requirement.
Small, very minor, you know, easy requirement to fill.
Yeah.
That's an awesome, thanks for putting that out there. I know there's lots of listeners that would be interested to know that. And I can tell you now, Melissa would be an amazing person to work with.
Definitely.
So.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa, for sharing your time with us and your stories.
Yeah, no, thank you guys very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. I really enjoyed talking to Melissa today. She is so insightful and had so many great things to say about her career and how it switched. And I think she gave everybody a lot of really great advice about going from being in a technical role to being in a management role. And many people are making that transition. So that was absolutely fabulous. I love that. I loved how she talked about what she's looking for when she's hiring and when she's trying to hire a diverse team. She's not looking for the rock star or the lone wolf. And I love what she talked about with imposter syndrome and how she's working with her friend from Microsoft on a talk who actually used to be her husband's boss, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
And how much they had in common when it came to imposter syndrome and the things that they've learned and what they want to teach the next generation and how they're going to put that together in that talk.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too. I liked when she talked about how in the beginning of her career, she was kind of surrounded by men and she thought if she just acted like one of the guys that would work for her. And it kind of did in the beginning, but then it ended up not serving her, especially when she became a mom. And we started talking about the little short film about Pearl that recently came out and how she could really relate to that film about you can try to fit in and be like one of the guys, but eventually that just doesn't work, and how you shouldn't try to be like other people, but you should be your authentic self.
Yeah, that was really awesome. I think the takeaway from me is the three key areas that she gave us, and that came from her Lone Female Voice of Reason talk. I really love that part where she gives three really practical tips about how to give information, particularly to an all-male crew or an all-developer crew or just a crew that you're trying to communicate well with. What did you think about that one?
I liked that too. I thought she had a lot of really good things to say. I thought when she talked about speaking to the data, making sure that you're speaking the language of that audience so that you get their attention, I think is a really important point.
I agree. And then the last gem in that was not being afraid to be wrong on the way to being right. I love that.
That could be a bumper sticker, like the best kind of bumper sticker.
Yeah. Okay, so let's listen to that again.
So I have three key areas that I try to do, one of which is always having data and always being able to speak to your data. Mm-hmm. You know, is backing up your opinion on data, especially when you're coming in with a disagreement or a potential issue, to try to avoid getting into emotional he said, she said, you know, my opinion is this, my opinion is that. And then one of the other principles is not being afraid to be wrong on the way to being right. Being comfortable making mistakes.
Yeah. That's a hard one for a lot of people to learn in general, right?
It's really hard. Right. Nobody likes to think of themselves as somebody who's wrong, right? We don't want to adapt that as part of our personality. But on the other hand, if you're never wrong, you're never learning.
You've been listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that connects you to extraordinary women for deep, inspiring conversations.